Hey guys, how's it going, man?
Good, good.
All right, so let's see. Let me be quiet for a second. There's the house behind me. We got about 3 foot property lines from the fences, something like that. And they're getting a new roof put on today. Oh, good. Right now they're slap tacking the felt paper on. It's going to get louder, man, when they break out the nail guns, which is going to be in just a minute here. So watch my level meter for a second with some dead air here and see if it's picking it up. Chat room guys, you hearing any hammering and banging out there? Yeah, I can see the green thingamajigs on Adobe Audition are picking it up. I mean, it should still be at like negative 60 or something. So I don't know if you guys can hear it, but if you turned your speakers up real loud, I know you could. The mic is picking it up. But anyway, I hope it doesn't ruin the show too bad for you today. Oh, yeah, that's getting up to negative 54 right there. Yeah, that's no good. Well, JDA in the chat room says he can't hear it. So good. I'm just going to try to ignore it too then. I mean, it doesn't really bother me unless it's bothering you. That's what bothers me about it. Otherwise, I don't care. I like roofing. I used to be a roofer. All right. Hey, guess what? Got a pretty good show for you today. You might want to retweet me. We got Adam Johnson coming on from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. I like those guys. Dr. Ron Paul. I'm a big fan of Dr. Ron Paul. He's going to be on the show. He's going to talk about some things. And Mohammed Sahimi. Our good friend Mohammed Sahimi, professor at USC and a great advocate for a nuclear deal with the Iranians, between the P5 plus one and the Iranians. And he's got a new piece on about the war party's attempt to scotch it. I'm thinking of more and more questions to ask Ron now, too. Let me see here. So Mohammed Sahimi, he's going to be on. It's sort of make it or break it time for this nuclear deal, man. I guess we'll see what happens. War party's doing everything they can to try to destroy it. Mohammed Sahimi. And then also Kamal Alam, who he's from some hoity-toity think tank in England, but he comes recommended by Brad Hoff from the Levant Report, who I really like. And I heard an interview of him on the BBC that Brad had, and I read his article for one, and I heard an interview with him on the BBC, and he was being quite frustrating to the BBC presenter who had his narrative and was trying to figure out how the truth fit in it and couldn't quite make it work. That can be really tough when you're talking about Syria for the BBC, I guess. Poor little guy. But anyway, there you go. That's going to be interesting. All about the Syrian civil war there. Adam Johnson, Ron Paul, Mohammed Sahimi, and Kamal Alam for you on the show today, guys. Which means I have very little time to let you know some of the things that I need to let you know. It's fundraising time at the Scott Horton Show. Therefore, now hear this. Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at the Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1-ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks. All right. So, by the way, about that raffle,
Maybe you like the show and you're considering, I don't know, maybe I would donate to support this show. He seems to interview people I like and stuff, and I think I kind of like it, but I don't know, a trip to Costa Rica, that sounds like a bunch of crap, right? Especially on the radio. I've heard of stuff like that on the radio. Oh yeah, take your trip down to Cancun or whatever, and then it's all a big ripoff, and the hotel is nothing like what they showed you in the picture, and whatever, whatever. In fact, I remember talk radio shows about talk radio personalities who came back and burned the advertiser for, you know, came back and told the truth about what it was and a big scam and whatever. And also, I got to tell you, too, just to be honest, I get spam email for vacations to Costa Rica in my email every day and other places in South America. But so I guess maybe, you know, a raffle for a chance to win a ticket to Costa Rica sounds like some kind of scam to people or something. But it's not. It's a fan of the show, Joshua Hughes. He owns a permaculture farm down there. It's not pretending to be some billion-dollar resort. It's, you know, I don't know how many hundred-thousand-dollar resort, right? It's a farm on a river in the jungle. You got your own private house, three meals a day covered for you and a friend. You got to pay the airfare down there, but otherwise, you're covered. And it's totally legit. And if you go to scotthorton.org/raffle, and click the link through to his website there, verdenergia.com, or it's, I'm not saying it right, but that's kind of basically how it's spelled, like Verde and Energia, nice stuttering, Verde Energia, but with the E shared between the two words, get it at the end? Verde Energia, verdenergia.com. And go there in upper right-hand corner, click those little bars, and then you can go through their photo gallery and take a look at the place, find out all about it. It's totally legit on the up and up. That's the only thing I have for sale is my honesty. Or I don't mean like my, I will sell my honesty, but I mean, it's the only reason anybody listens to me is because I'm obviously trying to not lie anyway. And so, yeah, no ripoff type scams here because it wouldn't serve my interest either. ScottHorton.org/raffle. Enter for a chance to win. You still got a pretty good chance compared to most raffles for something like this, I bet. So, check it out at scotthorton.org/raffle. And there's also all other different ways to donate. And like I said, you can get the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's, Fascism versus Capitalism, or you can get the actual book, the book of Sheldon Richman's Your Money or Your Life, along with a 1 ounce silver QR code commodity disc. If you donate $100 or more, you can donate per interview. If you like it like that, you want to incentivize me to do more and more interviews all the time instead of talking to myself, then go to patreon.com and you can sign up to pay per interview that way. PayPal, you can do monthly subscriptions or single donations or whatever you want. There's one guy who, he signed up for a monthly donation, 1 cent per month. I'll take it, dude. Hey, that's 12 cents a year. That adds up. So do whatever you want, man. You know, whatever. Try support. And if you own a business or you're part of some group or something and you think maybe you want to advertise on the show, hit me up at scott@scotthorton.org, and I bet you we can work it out. I won't charge you very much. I'll do the very best spots I can for you. So that's scott@scotthorton.org for all that. Oh, and which reminds me to thank Tom Woods. Some of you may have just finished listening to my interview on the Tom Woods show that we recorded the other day, actually. He had me on and gave me a chance to help promote the raffle and all that kind of stuff. So very kind to him. If you want to hear that, it's at tomwoods.com, of course. And, yeah, man, cool. So what time is it? Time to go. Join up the chat room, scott@scotthorton.org. No, that's my email address. Join up the chat room at scotthorton.org/chat, scotthorton.org/chat. And it's also an IRC Freenode chat room, hashtag Scott Horton Show. And you can also follow me on Twitter, at Scott Horton Show. Tweet me, whatever you want. All right, that's it for my news. I got nothing but interviews lined up for the rest of the show. So hang tight, Adam Johnson's up next. ScottHorton.org, LRN.FM. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here live Monday through Friday from noon to 2 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network. Our first guest today is Adam Johnson. And he's with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Yeah, right. Someday, I guess. That's fair.org. Welcome to the show, Adam. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. So listen, great article that you got here. 0 for 40 at predicting attacks. Why do media still take FBI terror warnings seriously? I'm really glad you wrote this up. I was just telling the people on the show yesterday about, I was talking with a friend, and it was a friend of a friend situation where he was kind of taking the temperature of what the general public believes kind of thing, you know? And his friend was saying, oh, my God, yeah, I mean, apparently this weekend ISIS is going to behead a bunch of people. And, you know, there's a real danger of the Islamic State and terrorist attacks across America. And I don't know whether I want to go outside. And he had to tell her, actually, you know, if you really look carefully, you'll see that they admit that they're just kind of making it up and they have no real reason to believe that's true at all. But then again, the general public doesn't really look closely. They just go with their impression. And so, you know, that's the important point. The impression has been gotten across successfully by the FBI that your picnic is in serious danger this weekend. Is
right.
That pretty much what you think, too?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a great study that was done 2 years ago that says the average American, or I think the number was only 40% of people read past the headlines. And so you have about 60% of the population whose entire worldview, and this is not hyperbole, it's actually a study, is actually based on headlines, right? So whereas there may be more nuance in what's in the story itself, the headline, you know, FBI prepares for ISIS attacks is something people internalize, especially when it's constantly reinforced over and over again. So,
right. And TV is basically just headlines out loud. They don't ever usually get anywhere nearly as in-depth as a written article
would. There's all this, sort of like, you know, they talk over, you know, B-roll of ISIS, you know, beheading people and killing people. Of course, this is when we say ISIS in America, what they mean, 99 times out of 100 is some dupe the FBI has either entrapped or got into an elaborate sting, which is bordering on entrapment. So, what the reality versus what people perceive as reality is vastly, vastly different. And I think more people are getting kind of hip to that, though. I think some people have kind of gotten terror fatigue.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, it does seem to be true that, you know, if you look at the attack on the Pamela Geller thing, and I forget now off the top of my head, but it seems like there's maybe one or two examples of actual, not FBI entrapments, but actual lone wolf inspired by ISIS social media types. More and more, it's become a self-fulfilling prophecy, basically, as the terror war has gone on this long, that you have people.
Well, I mean, the Pam Geller thing is a little bit different in the sense that, you know, if I was to go around with the big sandwich board that said, I hate the N-word around Harlem long enough, somebody would beat me up. If I was to go around, you know, Texas, you know, some sort of, you know, I guess white enclave and say, I hate stupid rednecks, like, it would be a matter of time. Like, Pam Geller deliberately provoked a reaction, and eventually she got it. It was just in the law of averages. This guy had been on the radar of the FBI 2011 before ISIS was even a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So he to say he was ISIS, yeah, he's an ISIS sympathizer, because that's the kind of that's the vogue Sunni radical group. But he was definitely radicalized, you know, many years ago.
Oh yeah. Well, no, I didn't really want to conflate him with the
right
overseas actual group, but just say that
right,
you know, there are, you know, potentially attackers who are not just FBI dupes. It just seems like it's almost always, as you say, FBI. And explain this too, because you in your article here at FAIR, you show the a still shot from CBS this morning where they're showing what looks to be, you know, more than a dozen arrests around the country for people tied with the Islamic State. And they're not making any kind of distinction between a wannabe, associated, entrapped, or actually sent here from Syria or anything else, right?
Right. And that's the problem, is that those distinctions are quite meaningful. You know, if I was to find, in 1960, if I was to find a communist flag in someone's locker, or does that make them a member of the Soviet Union?
Right.
No, I mean, ideology is different than actual operational connections. And when that line gets blurred, what you effectively have is you have us fearing an ideology, not an actual group of people.
Yep. And now, I'm really glad the way you went through here. I love fairness and accuracy in reporting. You guys do a great job. I guess you're pretty new around there, right? Peter Hertz Group?
Yes. Yeah.
What a great thing, man. Good job for you. Congratulations signing up with these guys.
They're cool.
Yeah, they're great. And so you have here 40 warnings, orange alerts, and scaredy-catisms from the top of the hour radio news all across in cars and trucks as they commute across the country over the years on TV, CNN headlines, and Fox News banner crawl, and the rest of it. 40 of these warnings that ended up being nothing but hot air.
Right. Well, the number's actually higher now. A gentleman from accuracy.org actually let me borrow an intern to do more research, and the number's up to like 55 now.
Oh, great.
The FBI has routinely predicted, I mean, maybe prediction's not the right word, but they foreshadowed a terror attack almost 55 times, and it's never once happened. And the inverse is also true. Any terror attack that was a real terror attack, the Boston bombings, the underwear bomber, the Garland attack, none of those were at all predicted. So it raises the question of what value does this have?
Right.
Even if one assumes the FBI is operating with the best intention, it does. We have yet to answer the question of what's the utility? What is the average person supposed to do with that information? Am I supposed to just go around looking for brown people?
Looking for backpacks.
Quite make clear.
Yeah. It is. It's clearly a bunch of hype. My favorite one from back in 2002 when, you know, it was obvious what they were doing. It's just trying to scare you into letting them attack Iraq was all it was. And they would have these orange alerts all the time. They were torturing them out of guys in CIA bases in Poland and stuff. And my favorite one, I heard it on the top of the hour, ABC Radio News, AM Radio News. A school somewhere in Texas could be attacked by Al-Qaeda. Well, there's only 500,000 schools in Texas, right?
That's true, yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous, you know? But well, everybody, be on the lookout.
They have to be somewhat specific to make it not totally stupid, but then they end up being so vague, it's just like there is one that parts of California, bridges along the Mississippi River, like, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, it's so goofy. Like, it's never been, and, you know, what's funny is the people make fun of the color code system under Bush, but I make an argument on Twitter that like, the color code system is actually the logical extent of what is already a fundamentally stupid idea, which is terror alert.
Right.
So, like, the color coding thing was actually an earnest attempt to make sense of what was something that was fundamentally nonsensical.
Right.
So when Obama got rid of the color coded, you know, a bunch of smug liberals were like, oh, well, you know, we got rid of the color code system. Aren't we so much more sophisticated? And it's like, well, actually, at least the color code system had some, like, criteria of what you're supposed to do, even though it was obviously stupid. But, like, right now it's just terror alert. Great. Now what? And in 2009, Tom Ridge wrote his memoir, and he basically said that he was pressured by the Bush administration when he was Secretary of Homeland Security to raise the alert level before the election.
Right. Yeah. No, it was all such obvious hype back then.
Right.
And then, as you say, too, and look, a lot of this is just, you know, internal FBI PR and posturing, too. There's nothing the FBI cares about more than the FBI and looking like they're necessary.
You got to keep fear alive.
Absolutely. You mentioned how they completely failed to predict the actual attacks that are coming. And you mentioned Boston there. And I had gone back. I'd missed this at the time, but should have known. I went back and found a Trevor Aronson piece where it was at the time that the brothers were, you know, planning and organizing the attack in Boston was right when the Boston branch of the FBI was in the middle of chasing their tail, paying no attention, entrapping the idiot into the remote control plane plot against the Capitol and the Pentagon that they made up.
Yeah, that's right.
So it was on their watch. They were just like in all my predictions for 10 years. This is how I'd always say it. While they're busy chasing their tail, the next real attack is going to happen right there on their watch. And that's exactly what happened in Boston.
Yeah. And you know what the FBI doesn't want to tell you is that there actually is not much they can really do. And the problem is that we have to live in a world of uncertainty. We have to live in a world where people are going to die occasionally. And we need to accept that. And the problem is that that's not a politically convenient thing to say. So we have to run through all this theater where the FBI is looking busy and we sort of feel kind of safe, but we're not actually any safer.
Right.
And I think it's all, again, I think after 14 years, people are starting to get really fatigued by it. It's kind of losing its credibility.
Right. Well, and of course, we could just stop intervening in the Middle East and then we wouldn't have this problem to deal with.
That would certainly help, yes.
All right.
That would
I'm over
most,
time.
That would be the most elegant solution.
Yeah, yeah. I got to run. Thanks so much for your time. Good talk to you, Adam.
You got it, man.
All right, see you. That's Adam Johnson. He's at FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, FAIR.org. We'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at Darren'sCoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren'sCoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. Darren'sCoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show, here live on the Liberty Radio Network, Monday through Friday, noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. Our next guest today is the greatest legislator ever in all of world history, my hero and probably yours. His name is on most of my shirts, the great Dr. Ron Paul. Welcome back to the show. Ron, how are you?
Doing fine, Scott. Nice to be with you again.
Very happy to have you on the show, sir, and very happy to have gotten an advanced copy of your brand new book. I read the whole thing last night. Swords into Plowshares, A Life in Wartime, and a Future of Peace and Prosperity. It's just great, and so glad that you did this.
Thank you.
So appreciative of it. And there's so many great points in here, I almost don't know where to begin. Much of it we've talked about before on the show in the past, over the past decade. But I guess I'd like to ask you, first of all, about the national debt. It's over $18 trillion now. And you talk a lot in the book about, well, you know, it looks like the empire is just not going to come down until the dollar breaks, basically, until the economy and the people's will to live under an economy suffering under the weight of all of this, when it finally just breaks, then it'll all come home. I wonder how far you think we really are from that, because when you make the comparison to the USSR, hey, they were communists. They were going to implode anyway, right? Their economics made no sense. And it seems like for all the Keynesianism and all the intervention and all the corporatism and frankly even fascism here in the United States, it's still a pretty resilient economy. There's enough market force to it that, as you also say in the book, we can afford a lot of empire. And I wonder if you think maybe this could last decades and decades still into the future or what?
Well, I'd bet against decades into the future because I think the debt is too great and we're not producing anymore. It used to be a lot of concern even back in the 50s. I remember when Barry Goldwater became famous in the 50s because he was complaining about the debt under Eisenhower. Well, he was probably a little bit too early. There's a big difference now, especially since 2008, since that crisis and the one that we're still in. Productivity is down. Structural unemployment is very, very strong. And more and more people are unemployed. They give you positive signals like the unemployment rate is 5.3%. But the jobs that are created are part-time, and they don't, and there are more full-time jobs lost. So So the number of people actually employed goes down all the time when you take into consideration the increase in population. So the numbers aren't there. But the question is, well, if it's so bad, why didn't the collapse happen 2 years ago or yesterday? Or why don't you say it's going to happen tomorrow? Well, there's one aspect of Austrian economics that more or less explains this, and it's called the subjective theory of value. And so there's subjectivity involved in this, and it's what people think is going to happen. So they can convey confidence to a degree, not forever, but right now a lot of confidence has been conveyed to the American economy because, like you said, if you look around, there's still a lot of wealth and there's still a lot of trust in the dollar. But if you look at the true value of the dollar over the last 20 years or the last 100 years, compared the value of the dollar today to 1913, well, it used to be what you could buy for a penny when the Fed started. You have to pay 25 times that. And so that's steady. I see it like the foundation has been totally eroded. It's a economy built on sand, and something's going to blow it down because it has a life that's sort of artificial. So we're on the verge of it, and sometimes we get special benefits. As long as we're the reserve currency of the world, this is going to last. And until somebody comes up with something else or they reject all currencies and people just leave all paper currencies, like people were leaving, the euro and the Greeks suffering the consequences, that's going to happen around the world eventually. But there's going to be people then go to real money, gold and silver, or some currency that is maybe established. Maybe they'll establish a currency someplace with Russia and China and have some gold backing to it. We don't know what that'll be. But there's no reason to be optimistic that in 10 years from now we will see economic growth and people satisfied and there wouldn't be. Because if we keep doing this, the discrepancy between the rich and the poor, that's the big political issue now. This is a consequence of this. This is why the middle class is suffering. And the discrepancy is what is going to motivate all the politicians. But until they give a free market answer and emphasize personal liberty and emphasize no more wars, believe me, it's downhill for us.
Right. Now, so speaking of dollar hegemony, I know, and this is something we've talked about in the past as well. At the end of World War II, of course, America's economy outmatched the whole rest of the world, basically. So there's just no question why the dollar was considered as good as gold, and it was partially backed by gold at the time. So having dollar hegemony as a legacy of that makes sense. But I wonder how far past the kind of legitimacy of that legacy do you think we are now? Is it because people say that it's the American empire itself that kind of forces the world, like our deal with the Saudis to denominate their oil sales in dollars, for example, and other kind of contrivances like that, mirrors and wires and smoke and bubblegum and shoestring kind of holding the thing together with American force is what makes the world continue to use the dollar in that way. But I wonder, I mean, is there anything else? I mean, are they going to switch to the Chinese currencies or some kind of market basket of other currencies? Because they all have their own problems. As you said, people, I guess, could just resort to bailing out of paper money altogether. But it seems like you're kind of implying that there are no other currencies really to compete with the dollar that are much better.
Well, yes, but I think that is already starting, and it's a consequence of our foreign policy for us all of a sudden deciding that we had to have the Cold War going and starting to attack everything that Russia says or does, and pushing Russia away from us. Russia was integrating with Europe. The Europeans liked trading with Russia, but we badgered the Europeans into accepting a negative Russian position. So we are forcing Russia to join with China and other Far Eastern countries. And now some of the oil is being paid for in renminbi, with they're using Chinese currency. So no, that's not the gold standard yet, but it all serves to weaken the dollar and also makes us more aggressive. So I think our foreign policy is speeding this process up, not only because it contributes to the debt, but also because of our stupidity and just building more and more enemies. I see the day coming when finally this breaks out, that the hostility toward America is going to be unbelievable because it's been held in check. People haven't been quite strong enough to express themselves, because if they do, they get sanctions put on them or we bomb them. But once we get a little bit weaker, there's going to be piling on. Right now, there's strong talk about the Saudis going with Russia. Now, that is a big deal. I mean, we have been the protector of Saudi Arabia, since World War II, when Roosevelt made that commitment. But I think there's a lot of things going on that potentially could change things overnight. Not that I think it's going to be tomorrow or the next day, but we are getting awfully close to this. And yes, we put on sanctions and we put our troops and around Russia and all these things, but there's going to be an accident. There'll be a false flag, or there'll be some unintended consequence. And this is going to break down. So it's one of these things that you ought to be prepared, but not sit on the edge of your chair and say, well, tomorrow's the day it's going to happen. You can't do that. But just think of how many Greeks right now wish that they probably would have taken their money out of bank a little bit earlier. They had years to be suspicious of what was happening. But no, the government will take care of us. We live in a welfare state. They have always taken care of us before. They'll take care of us. But all of a sudden, the banks are closed. So debt is the big problem, and debt is what will bring us down. Not only do we have that $18 trillion national debt, we owe foreigners over $6 trillion. We're the biggest debtor in the world. Our debt is greater than our GDP. So economically speaking, we're in bad shape.
All right. Now, this is something that you talked about a bit in your speech, or actually kept going back to this in your speech at UT, the Future Freedom Foundation thing a few months back, about how, you know, kind of no matter what, I think he even said all of the worst natural disasters even happen at once. Volcanoes and hurricanes and earthquakes and a war and a currency problem. Don't worry. All we need is freedom and everything will be just fine. Now, for people who don't understand what you mean by that, what do you mean by that, really?
Well, I say things like that and close to it, but I don't think I want to say everything is going to be perfect, but everything will be better. What I'm saying is that the only correction for excessive debt is liquidation of debt. And this is why the Greek thing has been going on for 5 years. They won't accept the idea that the debt is unpayable. They're only looking around for victims. Who's going to suffer the most? Which banks are going to suffer the most? Which group of people won't get their pensions? And on and on. But the debt has to be liquidated. The sooner you liquidate, the better. We prolonged the liquidation in our Great Depression in the 30s and early 40s. The Japanese tried to handle their debt by adding more debt. That's what we're currently doing. But if we liquidate, if we allow the liquidation, let's say that there was no bailouts back in 08 and 09 and no QEs and propping up and transferring wealth from middle class to the rich. If we had not done that, on the surface, things would have looked much, much worse. You know, immediately you say, hey, this is crazy. But if you do that and people have a right to work, a right to keep what they earn, they get their freedoms back, we stop the wars, we protect civil liberties, and even if we lost everything, you know, but if we have our liberties, I think it would have taken about a year to get back on our feet again. This is, the best example of this is the Depression in 1921. There was the liquidation of debt and the Depression after World War One and the Wilson years and the war spending and all these kind of things. And the GDP went down. I think it was up like 15% in 1 year, but the debt was wiped off the books. That's what you need. But it's sort of like painful treatment and nobody wants it. But if you concentrate on liberty and concentrate on reality about when debts get to a certain level, they're never paid. It's just that they're looking around for victims. And Adam Smith actually pointed this out pretty well, that nations have this tendency to get this debt and they don't pay. And so often debt is liquidated you know, by the debasement of currency. And that's what we're working on, or at least Bernanke and Yellen are working on so hard, is to liquidate the debt. They know what they're doing, but they're not trying. They don't come out and say, we want to liquidate the debt and punish the purchasing power of all people, even though that's exactly what they want to do. And they admit it. And along the way, they punish everybody who wants to save money and try to protect against this. So, yes, I strongly believe that if you take your medicine, things will look tough on the short run, but we would survive if we have our liberties. Today, the worse things get, the more authoritarian our government gets, the more intrusion on our liberties, the more spying, the more wars we have. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely the wrong way to go. So my vote is for liberty.
Yeah, see, I think that's such an important message, because I was speaking a few weeks back with Professor Alfred McCoy, who I'm sure you're probably familiar with, and who is certainly an anti-imperialist. He was in no way trying to, you know, rationalize or justify the empire. But he was saying, boy, when the empire falls, when Russia and China and Europe finally integrate, when America, as you were talking about before, succeeds in pushing all its former friends together in an alliance against us and that kind of thing, and our empire finally does break, it's going to hurt so bad. And I was thinking, well, geez, you know, because, I mean, and really, Dr. Paul, it's because I've been listening to you for so many years now. It seems like that's really the best thing that could possibly happen, never mind to the people of Iraq and Afghanistan, et cetera, et cetera. But for the American people, even if we do have to suffer a pretty bad depression when the dollar breaks or whatever it is, as long as we have free market pricing systems and so forth, then it'd be okay.
You know, and we're working hard at it, and I think there are some signs that the young people are changing their minds. But the real problem is going to be is they can't stop the momentum. Yes, they can temporize things, but the crisis will come and the financial system will break down and we will give up our empire. But if they haven't talked about the real saving grace of personal liberty, then there's no other choice but to have another totalitarian come on. And right now, why should a vowed socialist get the biggest crowds right now? And it's a government take over and redistribute wealth. And so they're out there, and there are others who lean toward fascism. I'm a strong guy. I'm going to take over. I'm going to be the boss. So they're out there. And our voices are getting more numerous, but we're not louder. And I'm not too worried about that. I'm worried about getting this 8% of the people who will be the thought leaders who will have an influence on the 51%. And that is where we're making progress. And that's why programs like yours is so important, to get more people to listen and say that, there is a good chance that we can succeed because we have alternative ways of spreading our message. And that's the only choice that we have, because most of us reject the notion, for practical reasons as well as philosophic reasons, that we can win this fight through violence. I just don't think that's the solution.
Right. And now, yeah, especially on Independence Day, which I guess that's probably the one American war that you and I would agree that we might be for, but you know, it's that assertion of individual liberty is at the very basis of American civic life, that we're all born free. And then the entire Misesian vision and the libertarian story that you've been telling all these years is about how, hey, guess what? Conveniently, it's liberty that works. All this socialism and planning and whatever, all it does is create distortions and worse problems later. It's liberty that actually creates the ordered society that we need. It's the mother of it, not the daughter. And you know, as you're saying, especially in times like this, that message is extremely important when so many demagogues are willing to say, all you got to do is surrender more of your freedom and more of your power and we'll take care of it for you.
Yeah, and I think, right now we actually have an opportunity because our message wasn't listened to at all because there was a tremendous amount of prosperity and there was a lot of momentum and there's still this prosperity on the surface and all you need is a good lobbyist to get hold of it. But more and more people now understand that the system isn't working and that we can't depend on it. There will be more Greek failures. And this to me is, you know, very, very important. I've many times over the years have said there's something wrong with us who promote liberty, because it's so wonderful. Personal liberty, you can do what you want as long as you don't hurt people. You mean there is more prosperity and there's more peace and we don't win the argument? I mean, what's the matter with us? Because somebody thought they could get a free lunch forever. But right now, the free lunch is no longer going to be free, and that's why we have to make sure that they don't pursue it with more totalitarianism and say, oh, yeah, but we screwed up. We didn't have the right regulations. We didn't print enough money. We didn't do this, and we bailed out the banks, and we should have given more money to somebody else. So that is a challenge for us, but I think we haven't done a very good job, but we better do a better job to convince the people that something as wonderful as personal liberty and owning our own lives actually gives us more wealth. There's still too many that don't believe this, but we need more people, you know, teaching this. And this is one reason why I've liked the Mises Institute, is because they work on trying to get more people into the universities and more people teaching this. But we have to use everything, whether it's the internet, your radio programs and things like this, to convince people to stop and think. You just can't keep doing the wrong things that have been so destructive financially and to our personal liberties. Every day, you know, there's another nail into the coffin of the Republic by some politician. You know, this past week, there was a big nail into the coffin when we saw Jerry Brown out in California saying nobody has any exemptions for saying that this government doesn't have the right to inject you with anything they want. So we better wake up. That's all.
All right. I'm talking with the great Dr. Ron Paul, the heroic Dr. Ron Paul, author of Swords into Plowshares, A Life in Wartime and a Future of Peace and Prosperity. Brand new, coming out. It's not quite out yet, am I right?
That's right, but within a few days, it'll be able to be pre-ordered, so I hope everybody keeps their eyes and ears open for it.
Okay, yeah, it'll be right there on Amazon. Of course, we'll link to it and all that at the website, etc. Again, Swords into Plowshares, a great book, and you really do aim very high in this book, too, and talk about the abolition of war. Shades of this book, The End of War by John Horgan, where he says, hey, listen, you know, we haven't succeeded in truly abolishing slavery from the planet, but it's virtually universally outlawed. And, you know, the people who participate in it are being hunted, and that's the way it's supposed to be. You know, that's the best we can do, I guess, in a world of 7 billion people. But, you know, slavery has always been with humanity since coming out of the grasslands. So, you know, this is a huge leap forward. And you talk about the huge leap forwards that humans have made in the past few centuries in terms of material wealth and advancements in science and technology and medicine and different ways of taking care of each other and pricing systems and all these things. And you say, hey, it's real. It's possible. Imagine it. We could abolish war from the face of the earth.
Yeah, and the world is so young. You know, when you think about recorded history, it's just in a few thousand years of history, and the Industrial Revolution is even much shorter. So I would say there's every reason in the world to have some sort of optimism that the human race can change its attitude. It certainly became smart enough to have such tremendous improvement in material things. And in the book, I mentioned that, yeah, we're all better off. We have such a you know, higher standard of living because of the material benefits. But they use a lot of that for war, you know, how to kill people. So what we need is a little bit of intelligence and common sense on why the human race can advance to saying, you know, war doesn't make any sense at all.
Right. Yeah, especially as you're saying, when the weapons that they can afford to make now include H-bombs and the kind of even conventional weapons that lead to such scales of slaughter that previous centuries of humanity people could not have ever imagined.
Right.
It's on the order of plagues, you know, the amounts of death from the world wars and the consequences in the 20th century. Now, something that's fun I like to talk about on the show, I don't guess I've ever talked about it with you, but I've brought this up to people from time to time just to try to get them to imagine, what if Ron Paul had won in 1988 and the end of the Cold War had happened on his watch? and NATO had come apart just as quickly as the Warsaw Pact, and we got our peace dividend. And instead of Greenspan inflating to disguise the cost of the creation of the world empire in the 1990s, we've just gotten all the way back to, well, I don't even know back, went forward to some real libertarian economics in this country. Think how there's our flying cars that we haven't had since the year 2000, right? There's all that great stuff that we all thought would exist by now. That's where it went, was the empire. And right. And the counterfactual, the reason I like to bring it up is because, hey, you're real. And it's a real possibility. It's something that really could have happened back in 1988. It would have been the perfect timing for the end of the Cold War. And then when all the neocons and all their warmongering and bluster about spreading our way of life to the rest of the people of the world. Well, what could have been better than America under the Ron Paul administration for showing the world this is what it's like to truly have a Bill of Rights that means what it says, to truly have freedom and free markets?
Well, hopefully we could say it would have been helpful, but I'm cautious in saying that it would have been a complete reversal of all those bad things happening, because you still need a consensus, and the consensus hasn't been there. Think about Obama is still subservient to many of the neocon ideas, but even when he makes a minor suggestion of just having a conversation, you know, with the Iranians and opening up an embassy, what is the consensus? Don't let them do it. We're not going to have an ambassador, and we're not going to allow any traveling. And these consensus in the Congress by those good conservatives is to stop it all. So that also is most important. Yes, an individual, even from 88 or 96 or whatever, that was determined. But quite frankly, if the sentiment is too strong, you don't stay in office. You know, they have ways of silencing people if they're pushing things faster than they think they should be. But nevertheless, anything anybody can do to promote the ideas is what really counts.
Mm. All right. And I'm sorry for keeping you over. Can I ask one more thing real quick?
Quickly.
Okay. You mentioned in here about the international institutions, the United Nations, the WTO, and NATO and CETO, of course, the treaty organizations and all that. Are you that confident, especially on the UN, are you confident that the world would be peaceful, that America would be more peaceful without the UN Security Council, which, of course, the whole apparatus is created in the name of world peace?
Well, I think no, other things that would happen, but I think the world would be much better off, because I argue the case for smaller government, smaller units, secession, self-determination. And when you have fast-track legislation for international agreements that are done in secret, whether it's WTO or who knows what, is the going in the opposite direction. So I don't think it solves the problem of the violence between states, but it'd be greatly reduced. I mean, you look at the mess that's going on in Ukraine right now. The IMF is involved, and our funds are involved. NATO's involved, and it would be more difficult if you establish the principle of self-determination and us staying out of those affairs. Then the neighbors over there would have to deal with the same thing in the Middle East. But I think the more organizations you have, the worse. I mean, when you think about the organizations that came out of World War I and the Versailles Treaty and the artificial lines that were drawn, that was the real culprit. But we're still at it. So maybe the names of the organizations change. But it's always these coalitions to tell other people to leave. Mainly, it has been so often, a way of getting hold of natural resources. And if people understood the free market, the best way would be is to let people alone. And what else can they do with their natural resources but sell them to us? So I think that the international organizations are a danger to us.
All right. Thank you very much for your time again on the show today, Dr. Paul.
Very good. Thank you.
I sure appreciate it. That's Dr. Ron Paul, author of the brand new Swords into Plowshares, A Life in Wartime and a Future of Peace and Prosperity. We'll be right back.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Got my ear goggles on. I'm live here on Liberty Radio Network, noon to 2 Eastern Time, 11 to 1 Texas Time. That was Dr. Ron Paul. Up next, it's our friend Mohammed Sahimi from USC. He teaches chemical engineering there. And also, he writes all over the place, has a gigantic archive at antiwar.com and formerly at PBS, Tehran Bureau. I know he doesn't write there anymore, but he's got a great archive there. And quite a few other places as well. And he's got this brand new one coming out for antiwar.com tomorrow. It's called Demonizing Iran to Prevent the Nuclear Agreement. Welcome back to the show. How you doing, Mohammed?
It's great to be back in your program, Scott.
Thank you very much for joining us. Very important article, and really appreciate your time as always. So, nuclear agreement. Looks like they about got it if this demonization campaign fails. Am I right about that? You think, as far as the leadership of the P5 plus one and Iran are concerned, they more or less got this thing hammered out, right? Right?
That's what my impression. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif, after some preliminary meeting in Vienna, returned to Tehran and then came back after a day. So according to Iranian press, what he had done was bringing to Tehran the latest proposals and the latest ways to address the disputes between the two sides. And apparently he has gotten the permission of Iranian leadership, including the Supreme Leader and President Hassan Rouhani, how to address these disputes. This morning, Zarif said that considerable progress has been made. Secretary of State John Kerry has also said that. And France's foreign minister, Laurent Fabius, also said that they are hoping to wrap things up by Sunday. But, of course, we all know that even if the agreement is signed, then it will be sent to Congress for examining it and voting on it. So the fight or the war is not over yet. We still have a long way to go, but the sounds from Vienna are very encouraging.
All right. Now, so let's try to not go too far into this, but we got to explain for the people who really don't know or their terrified mom who's been watching Fox News all week long or whatever about this. And I've been seeing some propaganda, some of the paid advertising and some of the statements in the press and in the op-eds. And you quote some of them here where they're not really clear in their accusations. You know, they say things like a nuclear Iran would be a disaster. And so, you know, my mom is supposed to be terrified, right, that Obama is signing a deal to give the Iranians nuclear weapons, right? That's what that's supposed to sound like. But that's not exactly what's in this deal. Am I right?
Well, of course, the agreement will limit Iran's nuclear program for a long period, between 10 to 15 years. And even after 10, 15 years, Iran will still have very significant limits on what it can do. For example, in addition to the fact that Iran's known nuclear facilities are under constant inspection by the International Atomic Energy Agency, Iran has also agreed as part of the agreement to implement the additional protocol of the safeguard agreement, which means that the IAEA will have intrusive power to go to more places and inspect whatever they call a suspected site. And let me remind your listeners that Iran, in fact, had implemented additional protocol between 2003 and 2006, which allowed the IAEA to get a very good picture of what had been done in Iran prior to 2003. which prompted former IAEA director Mohammad Al-Baradei to present a report to IAEA board of directors in February of 2008, saying that all the outstanding issues had been resolved and wanted put Iran's nuclear dossier on a normal basis, which of course was prevented from it. So it is not like you know, the Obama administration is going to allow Iran to make a nuclear bomb. Never mind that there is no evidence that the Iranian leadership wants a nuclear bomb. But even if they want, the restrictions on the program and the intrusive inspections that will be imposed on the program and the constant watching and satellites and intelligence and all of that will make sure that even if Iranian leadership wanted a nuclear bomb, and I emphasize that there is no evidence that they do want a nuclear bomb, they won't be able to do that. So it's not like the scary pictures that neocons and Israel lobby and Saudi Arabia lobby in the United States have been presenting to the public. Just like you said, they are very vague about it. They say, oh, it would be a disaster if Iran gets a nuclear bomb. Well, it may be a disaster if Iran does get a nuclear bomb, but Iran is not going to get a nuclear bomb, and Iran has no intention of getting a nuclear bomb. So there are many major differences between what is the reality and what they present to the public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, you know, here's the thing about this too, and not to you necessarily, but to the audience, to the general public especially, you know, people who aren't really specialized in this kind of thing, you ought to be able to tell that the accusations all raise a lot of questions and don't necessarily answer them. Whereas the people who are saying, no, it's okay, they all have very specific explanations about what's going on. As you just heard Mr. Sahimi explain, Professor, explain. Yeah, additional protocol this, expanded inspections that, and the IAEA record says that all their uranium is accounted for, and all these kinds of things that are actual things. But, you know, meanwhile, the war party is saying, nuclear, be afraid. And they're just counting on you to shrug and say, well, I don't know that kind of math, so I guess I have to leave it up to the experts. And the experts are telling me that, oh, my God, that Obama's done it again. He's going to give nuclear bombs to the mullahs. And why not? If you hear that 50 times and you don't hear anyone contradict it, it begins to seem like maybe it's plausible or something like that. But it's clearly just not the case, you know?
I totally agree. And a case in point is the nonsense about possible military dimension. The New York Times and other mainstream media have been talking about how the IAEA thinks that there was a military dimension or possible military dimension to Iran's nuclear program in the past, and they claim that Iran must come clean and explain everything that it has done in the past. At the same time, Kerry says that we absolutely know what Iran has done in the past. Well, if you know what Iran has done in the past, first of all, provide the evidence and documents that indicates that Iran did something nefarious in the past so that everybody learns about it. But the reality is that's not the case. It is all a speculation that there could have been some work done in the past, way before 2003 in Iran, regarding nuclear weapon research. And all these speculations are based on that laptop of death that was supposedly taken, stolen in Iran, taken outside Iran, and given to Western intelligence agencies. And nobody has even seen the laptop or the original documents in the laptop. All we know is that they claim that such and such information existed in the laptop. So these are all speculations, and places like New York Times and in particular David Sanger and Michael Gordon have been just advancing this narrative that yes, Iran has something to hide, and it did do some work in the past. And in fact, as I pointed out in the article, Sanger still insists that there is still some work being done in Iran without ever presenting any evidence. He doesn't even, for example, quote an anonymous official or an anonymous CIA official telling him that they believe that Iran research on nuclear weapon has been sporadically continued. He just makes a statement his own opinion
right.
and presenting it as a fact.
Yeah, just like always. Yeah, this is the same reporter at the New York Times who spent years referring, as you say, not quoting someone else, but just referring to Iran's illicit nuclear weapons program.
Exactly.
And then just leaving it at that. I'm sorry, we got to take this break. We'll be right back with the great Mohammed Sahimi in just 1 second, y'all. Hang tight. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, Al Scott here. If you've got a band, a business, a cause, or campaign, and you need stickers to help promote, check out thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. They digitally print with solvent ink, so you get the photo quality results of digital with the strength and durability of old-style screen printing. I'm sure glad I sold thebumpersticker.com to Rick back when. He's made a hell of a great company out of it, and there are thousands of satisfied customers who agree with me, too. Let thebumpersticker.com help you get the word out. That's thebumpersticker.com at thebumpersticker.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Mohammed Sahimi, professor of chemical engineering at USC, Iranian expat and peace activist, especially on the nuclear issue here. And we got a good deal. Look, we already had a good deal. It's called the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And under that, the Iranians, who have signed it back in 1971, I think it was, they have a safeguards agreement with the IAEA, and the IAEA has forever continued to verify over and over and over again, hundreds and hundreds of times now, the non-diversion of nuclear material in Iran to any military or other special purpose. The deal we're getting now is just double extra super that. It's just expanded inspections and reductions in the size and the quantity and the quality of Iran's civilian already safeguarded electricity nuclear program that they have there. So now, but the problem is like we were talking about, the confusion about nuclear weapons, and because it's such a complicated matter and because nuclear weapons are so dangerous, it makes this propaganda against Iran from the New York Times and everybody else, that they're and the rest of the war party, that they are working on nuclear weapons, makes it very powerful propaganda. It makes it not just propaganda for the people of this country, but of course to justify our government beating Iran over the head all the time for supposedly being in violation of these things and adding on all these layers of sanctions and all of these things. And of course, ultimately, the Israelis would like to see an American war and a regime change in Tehran there. And so what Obama is doing in negotiating this deal is he is taking away his own best and the rest of the war party's own best talking point against Iran, the outstanding fake but still outstanding issue of their nuclear program. And once that's all put to bed, then we live in a new world where maybe not only are we going to relieve some sanctions pressure on the Iranian regime and that kind of thing, but we might just have to let them live in the world with us and get along with them. This could be the beginning of a rapprochement of a peace, and it could be the end of any real chance of a war. And so that's why, as you document in your article here, sorry for going on so long, but I'm setting up a complicated story here. That's why, as you document in your article here, Mohammed, why the war party is at full tilt right now, doing everything they can to propagandize against this nuclear deal. And they'll change the subject from the nuclear deal to any old other thing, too, whatever they can say negative about Iran. Tell us more about it.
Oh, yes. And, for example, what they have been saying is that, look, if the economic sanctions on Iran are lifted, then Iran is going to have access to its own money, which is about $120 to $150 billion frozen in a Western financial institution. And then what they say is that if Iran gets access to its own money, it's going to spend all of it in the Middle East on its proxies and allies and so on, and therefore make the Middle East far more unstable than it currently is. First of all, Iran is not going to do that because Iran is besieged by a lot of economic at home. Iran's state of economy is dire. President Hassan Rouhani has promised Iranian people that after nuclear negotiations are concluded, he's going to address the problems with economy, high unemployment, inflation, and so on. And therefore, he's going to spend every bit of resources that he can get his hand on shoring up Iran economy. But at the same time, the other point that the war party does not mention is that the United States, a staunch ally in the Middle East, namely Saudi Arabia, which has a foreign currency reserve of about $800 billion, has been the worst source of support for all sorts of terrorist activities in the same region. Saudi Arabia, according to Vice President Joe Biden's speech at Harvard University last October, has been supporting terrorist groups in Syria. Saudi Arabia gave a political legitimacy to NATO alliance to attack Libya and transform that prosperous country into a no-man's land where all sorts of terrorist groups are now have a base there, and from there, you know, send arms all over North Africa and Middle East. Saudi Arabia supported the military coup in Egypt that overthrew the democratically elected government of Mohamed Morsi, and has been supporting and shoring up the Sisi regime in Egypt by granting it billions of dollars in annual aid, while Sisi has been torturing and imprisoning thousands of political prisoners. Saudi Arabia intervened in Bahrain to suppress the democratic movement in Bahrain. And we all know that rich Saudi citizens not only help terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda, financially, but a large number of them also go to Iraq, Syria, and elsewhere to fight alongside these terrorist groups. So while we are talking about things that Iranian regime hasn't done, we forget and don't mention what our ally in that region, namely Saudi Arabia, has been doing with its money, with support of these terrorist groups. These are the type of lies that they propagate about Iran in order to distract people's attention to the real problem in the Middle East, namely what the United States, Saudi Arabia, and other and its allies in that region, dictatorial regimes in Jordan, in Egypt, and so on, have been doing to that region. This is one type. And, of course, they have all sorts of other propaganda.
Hold it for a second, because I want to go back to what you talked about with they'll have their own money. I actually got in a fight with David Rothkopp, who you quote here, who's the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, foreignpolicy.com there, when he first was trying this out, on Twitter, the trial balloon. In fact, I may have provoked him into using it for the first time because he was desperate to come up with an excuse to oppose the deal. And so it seemed like he resorted to, if they scale back their nuclear program like this, then they'll get sanctions relief. And then what might they spend their money on? And I'm going, hey, man, talk about moving the goalposts, buddy. I thought we were at the world's greatest crisis ever was that they might get the atom bomb. And you're saying, yeah, this deal will do a great job of keeping them from getting the atom bomb, but they might send some more money to Nasrallah in southern Lebanon. And so now that's why to scotch the deal and let them go ahead and be closer, theoretically speaking, to an atom bomb than before. It just goes to show, and Rothkopf's not the worst of them, actually, but it just goes to show the dishonesty of the war party here. Well, they'll move their goalposts all around to wherever they want, when their real point is just keep Iran the enemy, that's all.
And let me mention, since you mentioned him, let me mention that a friend of mine, a very distinguished Iranian journalist, wrote a response to what he wrote in Foreign Policy regarding Iran's use of extra income if the sanctions are lifted, and sent it to Foreign Policy, but Foreign Policy refused to publish it. So he has sent it somewhere else to publish. So the point that you're making, and I totally agree, and I have also tried to explain in my article, is that they move the goalposts all the time. They make all sorts of claims, unsubstantiated claims, and they confuse people. And whatever they say, they throw in nuclear bomb, nuclear weapon program, and so on, hundreds of times, just so that people who are not informed get confused and scared and say, oh, yes, this is really a bad regime and it's really a threat to our security and so on, whereas the reality is far from what they have been claiming. And we all know that Iran's nuclear program is under tight inspection by the IAEA. We all know that IAEA will have even more access to Iranian sites for inspection. And let me also add one other point that nobody mentions, and that is if the United States, the George W. Bush administration, had wanted, it could have had a better deal with Iran, far better deal than the current excellent deal that they are going to get back in 2003, 2005. At that time, Iranian President Mohammad Khatami and his chief nuclear negotiator, Hassan Rouhani, who is the current president of Iran, made a comprehensive proposal to the West whereby Iran would severely limit its nuclear program. The limitations that they had accepted at that time are far stricter than anything that the present agreement will give the West. But because the Bush administration, this was in 2003, and they were drunk with the victory in Iraq, supposed victory in Iraq, they rejected that compromise. And the result is Iran made a lot of advancement in its civilian nuclear program, and therefore the limits that you're going to get on Iran's program are excellent. They are not any better than what Iran had already agreed to do in 2003, between 2003 and 2005, because at that time they thought that they can attack Iran and get rid of the program. But then the problems that the U.S. had after its illegal invasion of Iraq start to increase, and the casualty increase and so on, and therefore they couldn't do what they wanted to do to Iran.
All right. Now, I'm sorry. We're over time. I got to let you go, even though I got a few more questions for you. But thanks for coming back on the show, Mohammed. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you for having me in your program, Scott.
Great job again. And everybody, check out this great article. It'll be running over the weekend at antiwar.com. I think probably it'll be the spotlight here. It's called Demonizing Iran to Prevent the Nuclear Agreement. It's a very important article. It covers quite a bit more subject matter in there that we didn't get a chance to go over on the show today, too. So definitely check it out. And we'll be right back in just one sec. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Should have been able to hear that. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Our next guest is Kamal Alam. He is a Syria military analyst and fellow for Syrian affairs at the Institute for Statecraft, and had an article reprinted over at Brad Hoff's blog, The Levant Report. Oh, he just hung up on me. I don't know why. Let's see. I will ask him. That's the good thing about Skype. You can type to each other. Can't do... Oops. Show. All right, well, and if he can, then maybe I'll ask him about this article. I don't know. Maybe I won't. Maybe something came up. Or maybe his Skype ain't working right. Well, he's not typing back to me, so I don't know. Oh, well. What the hell? Pax Syriana, neither vanquished nor all-conquering. Oh, that much is true, for sure. It's about the war in Syria. It's got this long, detailed history about the Syrian army. With some mildly surprising, I guess, kind of details, depending on how much you know about the thing. Let me try to just call him back here one more time. That's one benefit of Skype is I don't have to put you on hold and get up and dial the telephone to make it go. All right, let's see. Kamal, are you there? Can you do the show today?
Yes, Scott, I am. Do you, can you hear me right? It's just that I'm on the street now. I'm happy to do the interview if the noise in the background doesn't bother you.
Yeah, no, you sound okay for now. Maybe if there's a... I don't hear any noise at all, but if there's a quieter spot, if it becomes a problem, maybe
yeah,
you could walk
I'm just walking away from the main road into a pedestrian area.
Oh, okay.
So I'm good to go. Yeah, I'm good to go.
Okay, great. No problem then. All right, so everybody, again, Kamal Alam, he's a Syrian military analyst and fellow for Syrian Affairs at the Institute for Statecraft, and has been a visiting lecturer at several military academies, etc. And Brad Hoff over at Levant Report pointed him out to me in this great article, a very interesting piece here, Pax Syriana, Neither Vanquished Nor All Conquering. And you write it here about how, despite all the predictions for now 4 years running, the Assad regime is in fact not on the verge of collapse. And you attempt to explain why that is. If it's okay, I guess I'll start with, is it because of Hezbollah and Russia and Iran helping? Or it's because of more internal factors and that's more of a side issue? Or how do you balance out the foreign intervention on Assad's behalf versus internal factors?
This is the conventional wisdom talks about foreign intervention helping the Assad government and the army surviving. But I believe that if it wasn't for the internal structure of the army and the state, there is no way the Syrian army or Assad would have survived for now more than 4 years. There's only so much external actors can do. Because if you actually look at the Russian and Iranian and Hezbollah support for Assad, it's not even half of what the Americans and the Gulf Arab states are throwing behind the opposition. So if we balance the two supporting cast members here, i.e. America, the European Union, and the Gulf Cooperation Council, their support to all the different rebel groups, half of them that are terrorists, far outweigh what the Russians, Iranians, and Hezbollah are doing to the Syrians. The bulk of the fighting is being done by the Syrian Arab army. Mm-hmm. And, you know, an army marches on its stomach, and there is no way in any military combat history that the army is able to fight in its own land for so long with foreign support. You need some local support, and people just seem to ignore the fact that Assad has support in his own country. Mm.
Well, now, so here's the thing about it, and I don't want anybody to get the idea that me or this show, that we're any friends of Assad here. I don't know exactly what you think about him personally here, but this isn't really about that. We're just talking about the news and the politics and the reality of the situation. And I don't think I've ever heard anyone argue that Assad is anything other than a fascist dictator. If anybody is saying, yeah, but... What they're saying is, yeah, but his opposition are a bunch of bin Ladenite head choppers. And so no wonder even large percentages of the Sunni population of the country actually support the Alawite dictatorship. Is that really right?
Yeah. That is right. Let me give you two big names who obviously you'd know who they are. Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski.
Sure.
These two, as you know, are the godfathers of U.S. foreign policy post-Cold War. And just in the last year, both Brzezinski and Kissinger are on record. You can find their testimony on C-SPAN congressional Senate hearings saying, actually, we must acknowledge Assad has support. Now, what that means is, yes, he's a dictator because that's the norm in that region. You know, everyone's a dictator. But, you know, whether he's a dictator that's ever threatened Western security or regional security, that's another thing. And yes, he's a dictator. It's a one-party state, but how many people were actually against him in the initial uprisings and how this turned into a brutal, brutal, barbaric civil war? So, yes, it's not about Assad the man himself, because it's not about one man. You know, there is no way one man can be in power for that long. It's the system, it's the state, and yes, you are right. A lot of the Sunnis support an Alawi leader. That's because he's married into one of the important Sunni families. His brother is married to a Sunni. It's not an Alawi government. It's just an Alawi president.
Okay, now, Just for oversimplicity's sake, if it's all right with you, I'm just a white guy in Texas here. What the hell do I know about this stuff? But if we could go back to the Libya war, it seemed there things were much more clear-cut. Everybody was a Sunni, I believe, basically. It wasn't so much ethnic or sectarian, but it was more the bin Ladenites in the east versus the commies in the west. And America took the side of the bin Ladenites, and they had the air power and all of NATO behind them. And it was really just a matter of time, even though they didn't have too many fighters on the ground. It just took, you know, I guess enough 9 months or so of NATO planes and special forces on the ground to finally just get the job done. Gaddafi didn't have much of a state really in the first place, or much of an army. He just had, you know, his own personal Gestapo, I guess, but was afraid to create enough of an army that they could depose him, right? So that one was, it was so kind of clear cut. Just, it was just a march west, and it's just a matter of time. As horrible as it was, and even though it took a lot longer than they said it was going to take, it seemed pretty inevitable. Whereas at the same time, the Syrian war was breaking out, and I remember Pepe Escobar especially broke it down like this, where he said, you know, it's a super majority Sunni country, but a huge percentage of the Sunnis support the dictatorship, because the revolution there is made up almost entirely of you know, suicide bomber, head chopper crazies. And, you know, there's it. So it's not the kind of thing where, like, the Iraqi Civil War, where the lines were very clear cut and that kind of deal. And that it was basically just the poor and the working class Sunnis out from the countryside who were even susceptible to joining up this revolution. And that virtually every other ethnic and sectarian group in the country, including all of the merchant class Sunnis, I guess, is how he characterized them, that they were all the coalition for the current state, as fascist as it is. Is that accurate for 2011? And is that pretty much an accurate comparison to the Libya situation, do you think? And is that, does it hold true today, if it's right at all?
It's definitely accurate in 2011 and through most of the current conflict. And, you know, this is, again, just like Pepe Escobar, the Britain and Europe's, and I would say the world's top Syrian expert was a man called Patrick Seale, who passed away a couple of years ago. Patrick Seale, who's an award-winning, best-selling academic and author, said exactly the same thing Pepe Escobar says, that yes, it might be an authoritarian fascist state, but he has the support of the majority of the country, including the Sunni elites. Yes, it was not a perfect state. Things were happening behind closed doors. But at the same time, there were no major calls for regime change. There were calls for reform. So let's not forget that the initial protests were definitely genuine. People genuinely came out on the streets looking for reform. But it got hijacked very quickly by, as you say, head-chopping terrorists. Yeah. Going back to Libya.
Wait, hold it right there. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we got to take this break. But we'll pick it right up with the Libya metaphor and all that, or analogy, right on the other side of this break. It's Kamal Alam. You can find this article at opendemocracy.net. Pax Syriana. Back in just a minute. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. All right, guys, welcome back to the show. Talking with Kamal Alam, he's got this article called Pax Syriana, Neither Vanquished Nor All-Conquering. Oh, that's for sure. He's at opendemocracy.net. That's where you can find this article. And he is a military analyst and fellow for Syrian Affairs at the Institute for Statecraft, which I don't know anything about. But anyway, very interesting article here, and I'm sorry, because I ask big, long, involved questions, and then sometimes they don't even have a question at the end of them, but you were going to respond to my rambling about trying to compare in a understand, you know, my best understanding of the differences, really, between the more or less ease of the regime change in Libya in 2011 versus America and its allies' very stalled attempt to overthrow Assad in Syria ever since then.
Yeah.
And so you were going to answer there about Libya and the comparison.
The thing what happened in Libya was obviously there was heavy American firepower used, whilst in Syria, American firepower has not been used on assets that are being used by Assad yet. So there is a key difference there that obviously if American bombs start falling on Assad's military and air force, you know, then maybe the story could have been different. Whilst in Libya, actually American coordinates and ordnance were actually dropping on Gaddafi's forces. But obviously the other big difference is Gaddafi never had an army. You know, as you just mentioned, he had a few private militias, and Libya had never really fought any war in its 40, 50-year history that Gaddafi ruled Libya, while Syria actually was the main force that stabilized the Lebanese civil war. And at the same time, Syria had a proper army that took part in the first Gulf War coalition. It was a proper army trained by the Soviets, the Russians, so it knew what it was doing. So, and also, it's a very much more sophisticated, civilized state, whilst Libya is basically barren desert with all these tribes who hate each other. They might all be Sunnis, but they hate each other. And if you look what's happened in Libya now, Libya is full of terrorists. There are at least 12 different designated terrorist groups ruling Libya. All kinds of, you saw what happened recently in France and Tunisia, and both those attackers were apparently trained in Libya. So we're actually seeing the, you know, the amazing success of the Libyan revolution, which has basically born nothing but terrorism.
Yeah, of course, it spread the war to Mali, I thought that this would have just been propaganda, but there's actually some pretty credible journalism about the jihadists in the Mali war hooking up with Boko Haram and help making them worse. They were already existed, but now they got RPGs and training and a little bit more indoctrination in the dogma of the Islamic State, which they declare their allegiance to. Man, I can't talk today. Another consequence of the Libya war there, yeah.
I mean, I'll give you another example. Someone I've done some work for, General David Richards, who's the former British Chief of Defense Staff, the equivalent of the Chairman Joint Chiefs in America. He actually came on TV during the Libyan war saying, we are not actually trying to do regime change in Libya. He was rebuked within 2 hours by the British Prime Minister and the Defense Secretary, Liam Fox. And there was a big rift in the British Army against the civilian government in Britain, because basically the British Army said, we can't take Gaddafi out. If we take Gaddafi out, there'll be a whole shitstorm on Europe's doorstep. And that's exactly what happened. So even within the military, establishment of NATO, no one really wanted to go after Gaddafi. All they wanted to do was create a no-fly zone and protect Libyan civilians that were being killed by Gaddafi. And actually what happened later was a complete mess. And today, almost all the so-called experts who were wrong in Libya and Syria are basically the same kind of charlatans who are calling for military intervention in Syria when there is no credible opposition to replace Assad. You know, it's just a bunch of terrorists.
Right. And in fact, you know what? I probably overdo this, but let me play this clip for you real quick. It's a couple of clips of Hillary Clinton when she was still the Secretary of State in 2012. And she's on CBS News. It's the very end of February 2012. And she's being asked, why aren't we doing more to help the rebels against Assad? Because, of course, that's been the narrative all along here, is that the rebels are the good guys and Assad, of course, the evil dictator. And so here's, you know, she's in a position of, she was really the hawk on this, but here she's explaining Obama's position, basically defending from that accusation. And she says,
we came, we saw.
Oh, that's not it. Wait a minute. I got too many Hillary clips here. That's later. It's here about Syria. That was earlier. I'm sorry. That's Libya. This is Syria here.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria? Hamas is now supporting the opposition. Are we supporting Hamas in Syria? So I think, Wyatt, you know, despite the great pleas that we hear from those people who are being ruthlessly assaulted by Assad, if you're a military planner or if you're a secretary of state and you're trying to figure out, do you have the elements of an opposition that is actually viable. We don't see that.
And so, and that was at the beginning of 2012. Before, I don't know really before, but right when Jabhat al-Nusra was really becoming a thing, way back then, though, you know, 3.5 years ago. And yet, that's really the policy that she continued to advocate for, backing, de facto at least, backing al-Qaeda in Syria. More and more we hear calls, even in foreign affairs. On the front page of Foreign Affairs, they're not even afraid to say it's time to work with al-Qaeda to bring them in from the cold, the guys that did the 9/11 attacks and 10 attacks before that, and make friends with them because, hey, they're fighting Assad. What do you make of that? In fact, let me ask you this, because everybody knows that America's allies, Saudi, Qatar, Turkey, and now even Israel have been, maybe all along Israel, have been on the side of the bin Ladenites there. But I wonder whether you think that there's some kind of real level of frustration by the Americans that, geez, all our allies are doing this, or is this really all just plausible deniability for what's a clear American NATO policy to outsource to our Middle Eastern friends the care and feeding of the suicide bombers of Syria, as the Israelis put it in the New York Times unashamedly? If their goal isn't regime change now, it's let's keep the war going as long as we can and bleed everybody to death, they said. Do you think there's much of a contradiction? Because some say, geez, we just can't control the Saudis. But I'm thinking, really? Because I thought that was kind of the deal, is that we can.
He says it's quite common knowledge that Saudis obviously use checkbooks and money diplomacy. They don't have much intellectual capacity to do good in the world, so they replace that with the oil money that they have. And, you know, this is a repeat of Afghanistan in the 1980s, where, you know, where the war in Afghanistan was portrayed as a brutal Russian invasion of Afghanistan, but actually it completely forgot that a lot of Afghans actually supported communism, and there was a massive indigenous communist movement in Afghanistan. And even so, very similarly here, what you have is the Saudis and the Gulf allies are basically repeating what they did in Afghanistan 30 years ago. And Turkey is doing the same thing Pakistan did. So just like Pakistan was the kind of frontline person that ran the American war with Saudi money in the 80s, now it's the Turks running that war. And it's going to hit Turkey as well. That's where Erdogan's lost his election, because all the major opposition parties of Turkey have come out and said, we don't support Turkish policy in Syria. Much more so, MHP and CHP, the two opposition parties, have actually gone and met Assad in Damascus, which goes to show you what the Turkish opposition think of the whole war. And that's where Erdogan's lost the war, lost the election. But yes, in some aspects, you're right. The Americans have basically outsourced some parts of the war to the Gulf allies.
But, you know, I mean, they portray the situation as though, well, the Americans, they're willing to train and arm the moderates, just a few of them, the CIA some here and the military some there. And boy, yeah, it's a little bit frustrating. As I said, they're now kind of spinning the alliance with al-Qaeda a little bit more, rehabilitating them. But the narrative at least has been, as Joe Biden put it in his famous comments at Harvard, that, geez, our allies have just gone and done something crazy here. And I wonder if you think that that's just cynical cover, or if the Americans really have been trying to get them to stop backing these guys, since it's become clear that, you know, the Americans, the State Department, Hillary put al-Nusra on the terrorist list as soon as they called themselves al-Nusra. So, but anyway, I don't mean to be too conspiratorial about it, but then again, it's kind of hard to ignore that, you know, they still to this day are backing some rebels, and it seems like all the money and weapons end up in the hands of the guys who are really not afraid to die, which would be al-Nusra and ISIS.
I think there's a confusion of policy as well. So from my own work with the military, and what I've noticed, the confusion in all NATO countries, not just America, is that this initial idea to support democracy and human rights, so that's how it all started. And there are a lot of lobbyists in London and Washington that are paid by the Saudis and the Qataris and also the UAE, who basically, these are Libyan exiles, these are Syrian exiles, who claim to be democratic and claimed to be moderate. These are the people who kept telling the Americans, don't worry, we look after everything, you know. But actually, it took America maybe a couple of years to realize that these exiles are all frauds. So what you have is a dual-track policy of still trying to find and equip a moderate rebel force. But even last month, General Mike Nagata, head of the U.S. Special Forces, who's in charge of all this, said, we don't even have 200 guys who are actually being vetted properly. And it's going to, and I think Martin Dempsey said yesterday, it's going to take a long time to vet. Well, I don't know how long you need when the war has gone on for 4 years, 300,000 dead. You know, there's just, the vetting process is flawed. The exiles in Washington and London are all Islamic radicals with without beards. They're all clean shaven and pretend to be moderates. And they charm State Department officials. And they cry about human rights abuses and genocides and all that. And yes, of course, human rights abuses are taking place. But the way these guys portray themselves is as if they are the good guys. And they start making comparisons to World War II and concentration camps and etc. Well, it's actually, there's nothing even close to compare this war to what happened in World War II.
All right. Now, forgive me for keeping you over just a little bit here, but can I ask you whether you think anybody in London or D.C. is finally coming around to the idea that maybe they could negotiate an end to this thing instead of just bleeding everybody to death forever the way they're doing? And if so, is there anybody to negotiate with? As Obama himself said, hey, the idea there are a bunch of, and in that Hillary Clinton clip, we don't see that. The moderates to, the moderate leaders to negotiate with, Obama said the same thing. It's, you know, a fantasy that you'd have had a bunch of moderate leaders, doctors and lawyers and pharmacists. I don't know where they got that line from. That's what they say on Fox News, too. Well, it was all a bunch of moderate doctors and pharmacists who were the moderates leading the rebellion until the terrible, until Obama didn't do enough to help them and the terrible jihadis came, et cetera. But is, yeah. So is there anybody to negotiate if anybody, like, say they wanted to bring in, I don't know, some third party from some country nobody ever heard of to host the negotiation from a disinterested view? Is there even a settlement available here at this point?
We see so far both the Geneva meetings failed, as you know, and the Moscow, the last meeting that Moscow held between the rebels and Assad. It's looking extremely difficult in terms of finding a new country to host it. It has to be a country with clout, and that's either Russia, America itself, or Switzerland being the kind of classic neutral country. But actually, the end to this war is not that difficult. People keep saying, oh, this is a terribly complicated conflict. No, it's not, because at the end of the day, if you know what the problem is, it's easy to, everyone in America knows Turkey's letting terrorists across the border. Everyone knows the money is coming from the Gulf countries. And if the United States and its allies want to put an end to the bloodshed, the first thing they need to do is stop their allies letting in the terrorists. And at the same time, then put pressure on Iran and say, listen, we've stopped our shit. If you don't stop backing the guys from your end, we're going to come after you. So for me, you know, it's the simplest way of putting it, that the diagnosis is there, you know, the prognosis is wrong. All the money being wasted on the rebel groups, it's not going to lead anything. The terrorists are taking more and more territory every day. Everyone, you know, even the so-called moderate rebels executed, you know, about 2 or 3 dozen people 2 days ago. So it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, the FSA has been head chopping and suicide bombing all along too. As bad as the.
But and also in answer to one of your, also in answer to one of your questions, there are people in America and Britain who, like I said, believe that it is time to stop the craziness. And as I said, Henry Kissinger and Brzezinski might be in their late 80s and early 90s, but these guys, you know, are still the people who everyone looks up to. They've openly called for that we need to go talk to Assad. Two former heads of the British Army, Richard Dannett and David Richards, have said, well, we must talk to Syria and Assad themselves to bring an end to this conflict. Otherwise, nothing is happening.
All right, y'all, that's Kamal Alam. He's at Open Democracy. .net. This article is called Pax Syriana, Neither Vanquished Nor All Conquering. And you can find him also at Levant Report. And he is a military analyst and fellow for Syrian Affairs at the Institute for Statecraft. Appreciate your time on the show today.
All right. So thanks. Thank you. Thanks.
All right, y'all, and that's the show. Thanks very much for listening. See you Sunday morning on KPFK.